Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we speak with Sarahlyn Marion and Taylor Varga, who are the winners of the National High School Musical Theater Awards, the Jimmys, otherwise known as. We also talk about Tennessee Williams' two-character play, Choir Boy, the unavoidable disappearance of Tom Dernan, and Frank Wilde Torrance, the Civil War. So please stay tuned.
My mouth, the rosy red, I'll pour peroxide on my head. No, I'm not doing that, no. I'll knock them poor old cowboys dead.
Elizabeth.
What, you don't believe me? Well, you just watch. I'll be so raunchy, dancing in my pink and green settee, feeling like a queen. I'll be so raunchy, gonna make them other gals turn green. Honky tonkin' every night, I'm a raunchy kind of gal. I'll be.
Hello,
so
and welcome
raunchy
to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, July 7th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Good evening.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist. His work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many other places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Hi, Michael. So speaking of your photography, you had a great piece at Talkin' Broadway where you had some photographs from the Jimmy Awards, right?
Yes, I love to go every year, and I got to take some photos of all of the well, not all of the contestants, but a lot of the medleys, these mega medleys that they do, these amazing mega medleys in which they go from one song to another, just really inventively arranged by the people who put it together for the Jimmy Awards, and showing off all this incredible talent of these amazing kids from high schools all over the country. And I'm just really glad that we have two of them with us today.
Yeah, well, speaking about the Jimmy Awards, let us introduce our guests. With us, we have the winners, the 2013 winners of the Jimmy Awards, the National High School Musical Theater Awards. And we're very pleased to have with us Sarahlyn Marion and Taylor Varga. Sarah is coming to us from Fullerton, California, where she represented the John Raitt Awards for Youth. Is that correct, Sarah?
Yeah. I'm actually from Westminster, California.
Okay. So where's John Raitt Awards covers a section of California, or is it?
It covers all of Orange County, actually.
Okay, the OC.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. And Taylor is coming to us from Connecticut, where he represented the Connecticut High School Musical Theater Awards from Norwich, Connecticut. So Taylor, are you from Norwich? Are you from the surrounding area?
No, the awards are based out of an office in Norwich, but I'm from Newtown.
Newtown. Great.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, both of you, congratulations. This is very
Thank
exciting.
You.
Have you been preparing for this for a whole year, or have you done this? Did you do this, Jimmy Award competition last year as well? Sarah, why don't you start?
Of course, my freshman year, Kyle Selig actually won the Jimmy Awards. And he was a senior at my school when I was a freshman. So, you know, my freshman year, I kind of saw that and I was like, oh, that sounds like something really exciting. I have to look into that. I have to see more about that. And so I guess I've been preparing myself for maybe getting a shot at even being able to go to the Jimmys, you know, since my freshman year. And then Elizabeth Romero, who won in 2012, was for my school as well. So it's just kind of a kickstart to get my motivation going. I've been excited about it since my freshman year. Yeah.
I believe the Jimmys, the awards are only open to seniors. Isn't that right?
Not exactly. I think what it is that you have to play a role in a qualifying leading role in a musical. And I don't think it, um, it matters on what grade you're in high school, because there was actually a girl who just finished her sophomore year there this year.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure. I mean, I guess a lot of people just tend to be seniors. And I also know that they've been giving scholarships, as part of the prizes. So I assume that it was for seniors, but that's great. So, maybe some freshmen will win someday.
Well, it's sort of like, it's like high school athletes that, whether they go pro or go to college, it's one or the other. So Taylor, tell us about your experience. How long you've been doing the Jimmy Ward preparation? Did you prepare a whole year for it?
Well, actually, I had when I was nominated for Best Actor in Connecticut. That was actually the first time I had heard about the Jimmys, and I was nominated in Connecticut in May, I believe, and then our award show was in June. So I guess I started preparing just right after I won for Best Actor in Connecticut in June, and that was June 4th, I believe.
Of 2013?
So, yeah, correct.
Oh, so it's been a whirlwind for you.
Yeah. And I also knew, I had heard about the Jimmy Awards actually previously from, in 2009, I think was the first year that the National High School Musical Theater Awards happened. In 2009, the 2009 Jimmy Award for Best Performance by an Actor was awarded to Stephen Mark, and he is actually from Connecticut as well. And he was representing the Connecticut High School Musical Theater Awards, so he was there this year. Kind of on the staff, so it was cool to see him there and kind of have a winner from Connecticut there.
I guess we should make clear to people that you won for How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying when you were in those local levels, and Sarah won for playing Dolly Levi in Hello Dolly.
Yes.
Uh huh. What I'm curious about is especially for Sarah here. We heard a lot of famous songs during the time when you came out again to do another song. You did the most obscure song of anyone, and that was a raunchy from 110 The Shade. Tell me the background on that. What made you say, that's the song I got to do? How did you know it? Who pointed it out to you? Tell me.
Well, actually, when I turned 15, my mom got me this huge book of mezzo-soprano audition songs, and it just happened to be in there. And
really?
I was like, oh, what is this song? I've never heard of this before. I don't even know what the show is. And I looked it up on YouTube, and I found the revival version of 110 in the Shade with Audra McDonald playing Lizzie. And I watched it, and I was like, oh my gosh, I have to learn this song. I don't even care if I sing it well. I just have to learn it just because. And it's been my go-to audition song ever since. I actually auditioned for and received the role of Muzzy in Thoroughly Modern Millie with that song, strangely enough. But it's always been, since I was 15, which wasn't that long ago, but it's been one of my great audition songs. And I really love working with different coaches and seeing their approach to it, because the performance that I gave on last Monday was not anything near what some other vocal coaches have instructed me to do. So it's really fun to see the song in different points of view, I guess, because there's so many things that you can do with a song, especially a song like Raunchy. So I love that song. I love the melody. I love the playfulness of it, and I love the difference in emotions that you can get out of it, because you can play it really serious and actually really raunchy, or you can play it really playful and friendly, or you can even play it scared, and it's like the whole shebang of emotions that you can get from it. Yeah.
Taylor, go ahead, Michael.
Oh, I was going to say, I was talking to Peter earlier, and we didn't plan this, but Taylor, your piece, your solo piece, was it not Santa Fe from Newsies?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, as it happens, our guest on the podcast last week was Alan Menken, and our guest next week is going to be Harvey Schmidt, who wrote Raunchy. So
wow,
and we really didn't even plan it. So
that's so funny.
Yeah.
Taylor, I want you to take this as a compliment because I really mean it as such. But looking at those three boys up there, it was clear as can be that you wanted it more than they did. There was something in your face, in your demeanor, that you really wanted this. I know they wanted it. Of course they did. But nevertheless, your whole demeanor just said, I must have this. I am going to get this, but I must have it. And let me also point out the people who have that attitude usually wind up being phenomenally successful. So I think it bodes well for your future.
Thank you.
You know, I've seen that look on Sutton Foster's face, and she's done okay.
It's hard to see Sutton Foster's face without that look, Frank.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Story. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if you guys know Alison Frank, the casting director, but Alison Frank has a term for that. She says they came to win, and she says you can see that in when you go into auditions, and certainly Alison sees hundreds and hundreds of auditions every week, and she says you can tell when people walk in the room before they even open their mouth if they came to win or not, and.
I'm not going to say who said this, but I will say that I do know one of the young men who was in competition, and he said to me, wait till you see this Taylor Barger. Oh, my God, this guy is great. You know, this is the one. So even somebody who was in competition with you doffed his hat to you to indicate that you were terrific.
And the great thing is that everybody, and Sarah can say as well, every single person who was there is supporting each other along the way, 100%. And at some points, you even forget that it's a competition. And me and my roommate were talking in the dorm one night, and we said, there's really no competition in having your own experience. Because that's what you were there for. You were there for the experience, and there you were there to learn. And you really can't compete for that. You just have to make it your own. And it just really works out for everyone in the end. And everyone is just so incredibly nice. And you really walk away from nothing but positive feelings and reinforcement.
I've seen all of the Jimmys to date, and the thing that continually impresses me is I'm just so happy to see such a mix of shows being done in the schools, from the absolute classics to the new ones, And of course, we might have our individual feelings about a particular show, but the point is that in general, that there's such a nice mix, it really runs the gamut. I guess it's a really good teaching tool for people your age, because before you get to college, one can't really expect you to have courses in musical theater history or something like that.
What I also love is the fact that they don't put you in a hotel ballroom, but that you actually get to be on a Broadway stage.
Yeah.
And that must have been astonishingly thrilling.
Yeah, completely.
They're speechless.
I'm still in a little bit of a shock. Like, I was at church this morning and people were asking me, how was it? I'm like, I don't know. I was on a Broadway stage. It's insane.
I've seen The Lion King at the Minsk Off 4 times. So I've been there a lot, but I've never, but I've been in the audience. Mm-hmm. And to like go up there and like stand there, it was just like Sarah said, like just so like you don't even know what to think. It's just like it's like all happening.
Can I assume you both saw the documentary that was done on last year's Jimmys?
Yes.
It was pretty amazing, huh?
Yeah.
Do you think it captured the experience to the extent that a film can capture the experience of the not only the award night itself, but the week leading up to it?
Yeah, definitely. The good and the bad. it really opens your eyes, because people who are outside of musical theater, they assume you go and you kind of just dance around for a little bit and then you just put on this big show, but it's really a lot of work, and the documentary definitely captures the hard work that everyone puts into it.
So why don't you tell us about both of your experiences? How long were you in town for a full week, or what happened there?
Wednesday to Tuesday.
Wednesday to Tuesday, and then what did you do in those days? Did you have master classes and rehearsals?
We worked. We worked hard.
And we ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner really fast.
Yeah. We had breakfast, lunch, and dinner, rehearsal, and then we got back to our dorms, and the only time that we spent in our dorms was to sleep and get ready for the next day. It was just boom, boom. You have breakfast, then you're in music rehearsal, then you have lunch, then you're in a dance rehearsal, and it was great. It was wonderful.
So, well, I do know somebody who once said to me, this really showed me exactly what it would be like to put on a Broadway show. And for that reason, I'm taking my parents' advice and going to law school. So, as you know, I mean, but this only whet your appetite to continue doing this, I assume.
Yeah, exactly.
So both of you, where are you heading off to next? Are you still have you both graduated high school? I'm not sure if I know that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And are you headed to college?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you going, Taylor?
I'm going to Ithaca College in Ithaca,
yeah.
New York.
Sure.
And do you want to know what I'm studying?
Or? Yeah, please.
I'm majoring in business administration with a concentration in marketing and hopefully a minor in theater.
Great. And Sarah?
Well, as of about a week ago, I was planning on going to a community college in my hometown and take some music composition classes and creative writing classes because I'd really like to be a playwright and a composer when I grow up. But, but you know, I'm looking into this audition opportunity for NYU with a scholarship. I don't know. Everything's kind of up in the air right now.
Absolutely. That's great.
Yeah,
Taylor,
but definitely furthering my music education.
Taylor, didn't I hear that are you currently rehearsing for a show?
Yeah.
What is that?
Shrek the Musical.
Oh, and where?
Lucky.
And
Shrek.
Yeah.
And where is that?
It's at the Palace Theater in Waterbury, Connecticut.
Great.
Oh, that's great. So how far into rehearsal process are you?
Well, we started rehearsing, I want to say, about a couple weeks before I left. So not too far in, but the show opens the 26th of this month, so we're getting there.
So you're getting you're about a week away from starting to tech and do things like that.
Yeah.
Taylor, not to open old wounds, but it's very nice that something nice happened to a kid in Newtown. I know the town needs something to cheer, and I'm very glad that you gave them something to cheer.
Thank you.
Taylor, I'm sorry, did you say you were going to play in Shrek? Are you playing Shrek? Or?
I'm playing the donkey.
The donkey?
Oh, that's
of course. Great.
That's awesome. Are there big roles out there that you would really like to do professionally in the future?
Well, actually, a little cliche. I told you I saw The Lion King a bunch of times, and I have never once ever played a villain. And I want to so badly, and if there was any villain, I'd probably pick Scar from The Lion King.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Okay, Sarah, how about you?
Well, I enjoy playing a villain very, very much. So I'd actually really love to play Carlotta in Phantom of the Opera. I don't know what it is about her, but she's just so fierce and crazy and insane. And I think that would be so much fun. And I think that role is really challenging. Not a lot of people realize, but how challenging it is to play a diva because you have to just create this entire alternate personality and live to it. And then, you know, in one particular scene in the show, she shows that she actually does have a heart. So I'd really like to play that role. I think that would be so challenging, but wonderful and awesome.
Of course, Taylor, there are those, including Bud Frump, who say that you've already played a villain, but that's another story.
A little bit, yeah. One of the interviews Monday night at John's Pizza, they were like, I told him about Scar, and they were like, oh, well, you know, Finch is kind of a villain already, right? And I was like, no, kind of, you know. I'm always supporting Finch, so I wouldn't really call him a villain, but...
No, not in his eyes, he's not a villain.
No,
of course.
Right.
Well, Taylor, you're in Connecticut, which obviously is not that far from Broadway, and you said you've seen The Lion King, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of other shows. But
right.
Sarah, you're quite far away in California. Have you been to Broadway much?
Not much, actually. Previous to this week, I've only been one time before, and that was with my mom, and I was doing a two-week workshop in New York City. And I saw Phantom of the Opera on Broadway.
Oh, there you go.
I've been in love with that show for forever. Just the music and the storyline. But I haven't, other than a fan of the opera and when we, at the National High School Musical Theater Awards, when we went to go see Annie, I haven't seen anything else on Broadway itself.
It's funny, we were talking in the last few months about Phantom and it's and the milestones that it's hit in the anniversaries, and there's actually, it just occurs to me, that there's never been a time that Phantom it has not been playing on Broadway in your lifetime.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
You know, it's crazy. So
it's almost a case where if you added both their ages together, it's almost true, too.
Yeah. Right.
Almost, almost.
Yeah. So a couple more things before we let you both go. Tell us about where you get your main driving force behind your theater satisfaction. Is it is it a high school? Is it your community theater? Or who do you have some teachers or some other folks that mentor you that you can pay homage to?
Well, definitely for me. A big, you know, thank you to the Huntington Beach High School Academy for the Performing Arts. I went there for all 4 years of high school, and they trained me in, you know, professionalism and musical theater and dance and everything. So I guess I get a lot of my drive from that. But my main inspiration, I guess I should say, is my mom. She pushes me and, you know, helps me get through awful things, and I wouldn't have been able to attend the Jimmys this week and, you know, sing that song on the stage if it weren't for my mom. She is my driving force.
That's great to hear. Also, you had mentioned that you had two other Jimmy Award winners in your high school. Was it that?
Yeah.
So you must have some real great support in the high school for the arts.
Yeah, I do, definitely. My teachers, Tim Nelson and Diane Makis, they are way behind me and fully supportive, and it's great. And I actually had Elizabeth Romero texting me, wishing me good luck and great thoughts. And Kyle Seelig was actually working at the Jimmys on staff this year, so he was, you know, giving me a little boost of energy and high fives, and it was really nice to see familiar faces while I was there. I'll say that.
Taylor, how about you? What about your high school or your community theater? Where you get your driving force from that's helping you?
Yeah, well, definitely in my high school, I've been doing the musicals there since I was a freshman. And the director, there was a new director that came in when I was a sophomore, and Jane Mattson, she's definitely been one of my big mentors. And also, there's another arts school in Newtown, Sabrina's Encore Productions, and Sabrina is the director, and I've known her since I was 7 years old. So she's also kind of been that driving force within the theater. And then also definitely my family. My dad gave me the brains, and my mom gave me the little bit of the talent. Maybe she sang Mr. Rogers when I was little. Apparently she sang me the Mr. Rogers theme song when I was little, and that's what she tells me, gave me the voice. So,
oh, that's great to hear.
We should probably ask Taylor, did you decide to become a business major in college before or after playing Finch?
Before. Yeah, when we found out, well, first when we found out we were doing How to Succeed in Business, I was like, oh, that's kind of funny, you know, like I'm a business major, that's, you know, it's a little funny. And then I got Finch, and then everyone was like, oh my God, Taylor, that's so funny, you're Finch, and it's How to Succeed, and you're going into business, and
that's funny.
Yeah.
What you realize is when you just gave those thank yous, you have started work on your acceptance speeches for your Tony Awards someday. So keep your notes. Make sure you thank those people when the time comes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Will do.
Thank you both so much for taking time out of your schedules to speak with us. And congratulations. Congratulations on your awards. And we look forward to seeing both of you on Broadway. And please come back and talk with us soon, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Have a good day.
Okay. You too.
It's so encouraging to speak with the upcoming stars of tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to seeing them in their next endeavors. So, from the two folks that we just spoke with into Tennessee Williams' two-character play. Peter, you got a chance to see this this play. Please, why don't you tell us about what you thought?
It's a very atypical Tennessee Williams play. It was first done on Broadway in the 70s with Michael York, an established star, and Cara Duff McCormick, who was supposed to be a star. I don't know what happened. She was in the original production of Moon Children with those legendary other people like James Wood and Edward Herman and Kevin Conway, Maureen Anderman, a really great cast. And I don't know what happened to her afterwards, but this play was done. It wasn't successful. It was a David Merrick production. It was then called Outcry. But this was an alternate title, and I think this is an alternate version. It is about a brother and sister who live in a theater. That's where they live. And one of the reasons they're there is they seem to be locked in. Now, whether or not they lock themselves in is up to interpretation. But one of the things is that it seems, and believe me, there's plenty of interpretation in this play, that they've killed their parents. And what this play proves is, as Jules Pfeiffer said in his play Grown Ups many years ago, killing your parents is simply a short-term solution. I mean, for a few minutes, you know, for a while, it's fine, but it all comes back to haunt you. And these two people have really gone crazy. They indeed seem to have an incestuous relationship as well. So Brad Dourif and Amanda Plummer, I think, are sensational in it. I will admit that this seems to be a minority opinion, but I don't care. Amanda Plummer really is very good at playing crazy. She looks bizarre as can be. I don't know what went on between Christopher Plummer and Tammy Grimes. Obviously, that marriage didn't last, but I know it was not a case that Christopher Plummer looked at Amanda and said, "This is not my child," because she looks so much like him. And it really, you almost feel like you're seeing him up there while watching him. But the way that she plays crazy and the way that he tries to temper her really makes it pretty, pretty interesting. Not a perfect play, maybe not even a good play, but certainly well worth seeing for these two people giving galvanic, dynamic performances as loonies that should not be let out of that theater. But people should certainly come in and see them in it.
Wow, that's a great endorsement there. So it's over at the New World Stages on 50th Street between 8th and 9th. I'm looking for, is it open-ended?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, hoping for the best. I don't think there's an official closing date.
Right.
Yeah. So, right.
I'm close to several people involved in the production, so I won't say much about it. But I will say it's amazing how, it's so obvious to me how heavily influenced Williams was by Pirandello and Beckett. In this play, it's really very, very existential and playing with different levels of reality. And there's, you know, just, it's really fascinating. And I don't think Peter, my impression is that the reviews have been all over the place, which is not unexpected with a play that's so unusual. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you're necessarily in the minority opinion on the acting, I know several people, certainly agree who would think that they're both kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, I hope not from the vantage point that I need to be right, but from the vantage point that I think they really should be appreciated. By the way, Amanda also gives us the impression that the time is fast coming when she can play Blanche DuBois, and she'll do a hell of a job with it too.
That's interesting what you said about, that's very true about her physical resemblance to her father. And I always thought that vocally she bore more than a passing resemblance to her mother.
Right.
And I was told, did I mention this to you, Peter? After seeing this production, I was told by someone that not too many years ago that her mother actually did, I believe, some kind of a reading of the play in the role that Amanda's now playing, Tammy Grimes and Joel Vig.
Yes.
So that's an interesting little tidbit.
Sure.
So something interesting, I'm looking at their website, and they make this, they've got a quote on their website from Tennessee Williams. It says, "It's my most beautiful play since Streetcar," which I think, I don't know, it hits me funny that it's a quote from Tennessee Williams about himself. It's self-referential.
Yes, it is. However, we must applaud him for trying something very different from what he had ever done before. This is not boilerplate Tennessee Williams.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
So at least that.
All right. So moving on next, Michael got a chance to see Choir Boy. Off the air, we had mentioned that Michael even paid for these tickets because they didn't seem to be giving out tickets. But Michael, that's not going to hold back our opinion, is it?
No, but our opinion, the royal we, is very right. positive. And apparently the play has been getting very, very positive
yes.
reviews. I'm not surprised. It's quite wonderful. It's by Terrell Alvin McCraney. And it's in the smallest space, the smaller of the two spaces at the MTC on 55th Street, the studio at Stage 2 is what it's called. And actually, that theater, it seems to me that every time I've been at it previously, it's been general admission, but in this case, it wasn't. There was assigned seats. So for whatever that's worth, you don't need to get there especially early because you'll get the same seat whenever you get there. Very well directed by Trip Cullman in three-quarter thrust configuration, and basically it's about it's set in a school, all African American high school level place, or maybe it's college level, I'm not sure, and they have this choir that this very, very well established famous choir that most of the characters are members of. And in fact, all of the characters are members of it with two exceptions. Chuck Cooper plays the headmaster. And then Austin Pendleton, who is the only non-African-American in the cast, plays a teacher named Mr. Pendleton who comes to the school. And that is there's two really interesting things going on here. The main one of the interesting things is that the central character, I guess, whose name is Farris, Pharus, Farris Jonathan Young, played by Jeremy Pope, is very openly gay and quite flamboyant. So that leads to all kinds of complications with the way that the other boys relate to him, and some much more positively than others, let's put it that way. But then there's also this very, very interesting subplot where the Austin Pendleton character apparently had been very heavily involved in the early civil rights movement, and so he comes to the school with all of that history behind him. And at one point, I will really never forget this. The character is basically a very kind of scholarly, pretty much soft-spoken character, very intellectual, doesn't really raise his voice ever, speaks in very cultured, modulated tones. But at one point, a bunch of the boys are on stage, and one of them just keeps referring to another one as, nigger. Keeps calling him nigger in the very offhand way that unfortunately happens so often mm-hmm. among African American male. And well, anyway, Austin Pendleton as Mr. Pendleton absolutely freaks out and starts screaming at him, don't use that word. That is an ugly word. You have no idea what that means and what people have gone through to get people to stop using that word. And you could hear a pin drop in the theater. It was an amazing, amazing moment. And I'm glad that, that point was made, especially by an African-American playwright. So it's very well worth seeing. It was to be a very limited run. I think they added a couple of weeks, and I don't think they can add any more. But I'm sure that you're going to see this elsewhere. This was a co-production, by the way, with the Alliance Theater. And I'm you can bet your bottom dollar, as they used to say, that that it will be done elsewhere, and it really deserves to, and everyone should absolutely see it.
Last week I was talking about The Color Purple at the high school thespian festival in Nebraska, and how one of the young men had a father in prison, and how wonderful it was that he has escaped that fate by finding theater. This is true of Mr. McCraney, too. He definitely has at least a brother in prison, and maybe more than that. I interviewed him a long time ago when The Brother's Size was being done some years back. And it's really wonderful how theater has really saved him, and he does have such a huge natural gift. His theatrical inclinations are phenomenal, especially with The Brother's Size. It was just trilogy. It's hard enough to write one play, but to have three plays interconnect the way they did was just mind-boggling. So I'm delighted with his success. He's a lovely young man. May he live to be 100, and may he write plays every day that of those 100 years.
Peter, I when you mentioned that last week, I was going to say something, and I didn't find the appropriate moment to say it, but I feel like I should say it as well now, is that for much of my childhood, my father was in prison. And I spent a lot of time with people outside of my family because my father was in prison. And theater really was very tremendously helpful to me, so I can appreciate exactly what you're saying, and I think that it's a really great thing to have somewhere else to turn, to have another group of people to call your family as well. And I totally agree with you, and I think that that is it's a really astute observation you're bringing up there. So I think that Choir Boy, as Michael mentioned, has extended a number of times, and it is a very hot ticket to get right now. So if you get a chance to get to see it, what do you think the possibility of this transferring to a Broadway run, either in the fall or maybe the spring? What do you think about that?
Well, you know, normally it would be, I would say without question, it would be on Broadway, and it should be on Broadway, but, you know, with the current Broadway climate the way it is. But on the other hand, since it's a Manhattan Theater Club co-production, I imagine that they could just, you know, put it into the Friedman as part of their subscription, if that's not all sewed up, you know. But maybe if not next season, maybe the following season, or maybe they'll find a place to slip it in. I'm sure, you know, I can practically guarantee it.
Yeah, so it's if you're not able to get a ticket to it right now, as it is very highly booked up, hopefully we will be able to see it again come the fall of the spring season. So next up on our agenda here is that Peter got a chance to see a roundabout production of the unavoidable disappearance of Tom Dernan. The unavoidable disappearance of Tom Dernan.
Bravo.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Peter, why don't you tell us about that? It's at the Laura Pels.
Well, there's a lot of prison talk in this podcast tonight, yeah. Because indeed, this is about a gentleman who committed a white-collar crime, not unlike Bernie Madoff, but obviously far less severe, because he had to do 5 years in prison. And what the play teaches us is the fact that when you serve your sentence in prison, frankly, that's your easiest time that you will have for the rest of your life, because once you get out, that's when things really get hard and really get sticky. His family does not want to know him. His wife has moved on. She has divorced him. She has found somebody else. His son certainly doesn't want to have much to do with him, but is pulled by the fact that, after all, this is his father, and allows the father to come live with him for a very finite period of time. And what's so sad is the fact that the father wants to make a connection with the son, and the son is busy. You know, the son has his own life, and the father says, "What are you doing?" You know, that type of thing, the way our parents have always driven us crazy with little questions like that, just to engage us in conversation. And that's what's going on here. And the kid just wishes he'd just leave him alone. But the father needs to connect, and the father also needs to be forgiven. And he really feels he has paid his debt to society, and therefore he should be forgiven. Well, yes, that is one way of looking at it, but it's not that easy for people to say, oh, I can now switch my feelings off because 5 years have passed and he served his sentence. It's not that easy at all. David Morse is sensational in playing the in playing Tom Dernan, the criminal. So tremendously, and in the middle of all this, what's really ironic is he actually took time out to do a one-night benefit of How I Learned to Drive, in which he played the part of the man who molested his niece, I guess it was. And what was wonderful about David in that play was the fact that you could see that he wasn't a bad man. He was a person who had a bad affliction that he really meant well. I mean, he really loved this girl and he really wanted to marry her. His intentions were as honorable as they could be, but you know, she's still a young kid, and I mean, he shouldn't have manipulated the way he did. Well, here, you know, he just feels, you know, as he says, I fucked up. Okay, I did. I admit my guilt. I admit it. Let's move on. They don't want to move on. And meanwhile, what's also interesting is that the son is getting involved with a girl, and he doesn't want the girl to know that indeed his father has had this background, and he lies tremendously to her about who his father. My father's dead. You know, he doesn't mean dead to me. He means dead, period. And that's the impression he gives. And then she finds out that the father's alive and she feels betrayed because he lied to her. But this brings up another point that's so interesting about the play, that again, the sins of the father aren't passed on to the kid because he doesn't want to admit that he's the son of a criminal. So as a result, he's doing what he can to lie about it, but then she begins to not trust him, figuring if he lies about that, what else is he lying about? So again, a complicated Gordian knot of a play, and a very, very good one, beautifully done, and the season, of course, is only a month old, but I hope we get at least a play like this every month, because if we do, it'll be quite a season.
Well, you know, to go back to the previous discussion, yes, I mean... I applaud producers who are, you know, at least I guess smart enough to when they find something really good like Choir Boy or The Unavoidable Disappearance of Tom Dernan, they, you know, I hate to say it, but I think it's smart of them just to not just put it directly on Broadway, because unless it's got, you know, Tom Hanks or Alec Baldwin in it, it's going to close. And even if it does have Alec Baldwin in it, it might close. Right. Even, you know, but so I guess that's the new normal. You know, these things, they just have to be tried out. And in the case of Choir Boy, the reason that I wasn't offered tickets is it was initially planned as an extremely limited run. You know, I guess they really just wanted to test the waters. And then when something gets great response like Choir Boy and the Tom Dernan play, you know, that might be enough to give it the impetus to be done on Broadway even without stars. So I guess that is the new normal.
And we were, before we started recording, we talked about David Morse, and I'm a huge fan of David Morse. I haven't seen this show, but he does that silent, powerful, make you uneasy in your chair type of thing really well.
And so, it's funny because I'm was it St. Elsewhere? Is that what he became famous?
Yeah, he was big in St. Elsewhere.
Then. Well, I did not. I mean, that wasn't one of my shows. But I think, was he not a very very likable, upstanding person in that?
Yeah, yeah. He was a very well liked doctor in St. Elsewhere.
Whereas his theater career has, as James mentioned earlier, I think has been largely the opposite. You know, I mean, but that's the thing. He's able to humanize characters like this, you know, neo Bernie Madoff person, and the character in How I Learned to Drive, who, you know, who sexually molests his niece. You know, I think that's why I mean, that's a great actor who can bring humanity to characters like that.
I first saw him 1974 in Boston. I believe he's from Boston because he was working with a company that I think was called Boston Rep. It's not around anymore, long gone. It really looked like it was going to do terrifically well for a while there. And he was terrific in a play called Murder at the Boston Garden, which really was a nice hometown show about the Celtics having problems. I remember him playing a very goofy basketball player and doing a very fine job of it. So that's the first time I saw him. So here he is, 40 years later, still with a career. It's terrific.
He is from Beverly, Massachusetts.
Was that right?
Yeah. Raised in Hamilton. He was born in Beverly and raised in Hamilton, Massachusetts. One of the other things, I have to go back and look at this saying elsewhere, see if I could find it on YouTube or something like that, but it seems like he has not aged a day. It seems like he's like the same exact thing, although I might be remembering it incorrectly, but I was a big fan of St. Elsewhere, too. All right. So, as we mentioned, it's at Roundabout's Laura Pels Theater. Check it out there. There's a link to it in the show notes. So if you want to go to the Roundabout site and check it out, you can. There's some video clips there that are you can watch as well. Last week we mentioned that Peter was jumping on a horse and heading down to Gettysburg to see this Frank Wilde Towards the Civil War. And this was at the Gettysburg Community Theater, isn't that correct?
Yeah, really. Frankly, I took my Toyota Camry and I had an easier time of it. But I was at the world premiere of The Civil War, the musical, mind you, in New Haven before it came to Broadway at the St. James, where I attended the opening night. I like this production the best of the three that I've seen because it was so small. So these songs really scored much better in a theater that seemed to seat fewer than 100 seats. And there are some tender, tender songs in this show. And I suddenly realized that even though this did get a Tony nomination, it was in one of those years where they were scrambling to find scores to give Tony nominations to. But I think it was deserved. I really do. Some of these songs have wonderful ideas behind them. Jack Murphy and Greg Boyd and Frank Wilde on. They all wrote lyrics. I don't know who wrote what. But there's one where a nurse is talking about dealing with a patient that she doesn't know his name. And during the song, he dies. And she says, "I'm glad I didn't know his name because I, as much as I knew him, you know, I cared about him so much and I really felt for him. And you know, if I knew his name, it'd be even worse, you know." So that's good. There are songs that two brothers sing, each of them on opposite sides of the Civil War, which was a very potent song as well. A song called Tell My Father, in which a guy is dying and he wants his father to know that he died being strong and valiant and all that. And you think, well, yeah, okay, but you're still dying. And, you know, if there weren't this war, if this could have been settled, you and 620,000 other people could have lived, you know. I mean, it was the Civil War, you know, I think it's like more than all wars put together. More Americans died. Of course, we understand why from the vantage point that everybody who died was an American, but nevertheless, pretty harrowing stuff. And so those were really very, very well done. I really enjoyed seeing these people put their hearts and souls into these songs in a way that they really hit the back wall of the theater because it wasn't so far away. Even a song like Old Gray Coat, which is a song which is an up-tempo song about a guy saying, you know, my coat doesn't have any buttons anymore. You know, it's muddy. You can barely even see that it was gray, but I'm still wearing this old gray coat and it's still going, you know. And this comes at a point where you know that his side is going to lose the Civil War, and it's his last burst of enthusiasm where he can possibly come away with any type of feeling whatsoever of victory. It's the best that he can do. So a very nice show and very, very well directed. You know, three people directed it, but I think the most credit probably goes to Chad Allen Carr because he's the founding executive and the artistic director of this theater. Didn't exist until a few years ago. See, what had happened was there's a bigger theater in town, an old theater that was fallen into disrepair. And a lot of the townspeople said, "We've got to do something about this. We've got to save this theater." So not only did they find the money, and they certainly credit Ed Rendell, Philadelphia's champion of the arts, and in helping them quite a bit. And they renovated the theater, and they decided, you know, for an opening show, let's do the Civil War, because, I mean, after all, we're Gettysburg. And it went over very, very well, but it hadn't been done since. And so this is the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Battle. Last week was the anniversary on July 1st and July 2nd and July 3rd. It was that big a battle. So that's why the Chad Allen Carr decided to do it now. It was the right time to do it. And it was pretty moving to see people in that audience in tears and cheering at the end too. So I think this is a very nice community theater, and I wish it well down there in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. It really was worth driving 400 miles, which was round trip, to see the show. So I'm glad I did it.
All right, so moving on, in the week in review, The Jungle Book opened up at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. We will see if it's going to be a contender to come into Broadway. What do you guys think? Is this type of thing something that can be a goer on Broadway?
Well, I have no idea, but I will say that, you know, the ones that where a lot of the main characters are animals are obviously harder to do than
sure
the ones where they're humans. That's the one thing I'll say.
It's a jungle out there. No, but actually, the thing is that Mary Zimmerman, who's
yes.
an amazing director and certainly has won a Tony Award, so this is not just a boilerplate rendition
no.
of the show. I mean, if Mary Zimmerman's involved, then indeed you can bet that this is going to have a look as distinctive as the one that Julie Taymor brought to The Lion King.
Yeah, I think there's a natural comparison to The Lion King, and I kept on trying to come up with something that was not comparing it to, but it does keep coming back to that. But although, you know, who's to argue with the success of The Lion King?
Of course not. Mary said one of my favorite things. It was a simple statement, but she teaches out there in Chicago. And she said one point, in the middle of nowhere, you know, she was just talking and suddenly said, "My students beguile me." And I love that. I love the idea that students beguile, you know. So I wish that all students would beguile. But I guess they don't. But Mary's do. So that's nice.
So after Chicago, it's going to transfer to Boston's Huntington Theater Company, and it's going to run in September, and we'll see what happens there. Reviews were generally pretty good, solid out there. So
I have to admit, I don't know the original property. Do you?
Well, I know the Disney movie. You know, yeah, I haven't seen it in a few years, but certainly... certainly, it's a classic, and I wonder how, because, you know, it was written in a time when we may not have been so sensitive to cultural references. So I wonder if it's been updated in that type of with that in mind, because it could be a very big stereotype mm-hmm. on the subcontinent of Asia and in India.
Also, I'm not familiar with the movie either, really. I mean, I know a couple of the songs, but I think it's not a full Broadway length score. So I'm ashamed to say I haven't done the research. Do we know who filled out the score?
Mm.
Was it the Sherman Brothers?
Yeah,
it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of them is gone.
It says that the show uses songs created by Richard and Robert Sherman for the film.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't look like they've augmented it.
That's all it says, really?
It's all it says. I haven't seen anything else.
Oh, well, then maybe there are more songs than I realize, or maybe they're just maybe there just aren't a lot of songs in it.
Or it's like Andrew Lloyd Webber. They just repeat them over and over. Did I say that out loud? Wait, okay.
Well, last week we talked with Alan Menken, and we mentioned Aladdin and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. So I guess there's a lot of Disney in the pipeline, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it seems like Disney has gone full out in making Broadway part of a full-fledged brother to the Hollywood studio. It's funny, Michael and I were chatting before we started recording today about the about how Hollywood is going through a lot of a lot of changes. And it was Spielberg and Lucas were quoted as saying that that the Hollywood model has to change or else Hollywood's not going to exist in its form that we see it today.
Yeah, they really did, were very, very adamant about it, that they said that this system is broken where, you know, and there was even the quote, which I appreciated, how many times can you see the same cities destroyed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's really what it comes out. I just saw, off topic for a moment, I just saw Man of Steel, and it's just appalling. It's just nothing but one tremendous explosion or gunfight or building mm-hmm. toppling after another, and aside from everything else, you think to yourself, well, don't they realize that if you have 8 of those sequences in a movie, that each one of them becomes that much less effective than if there were only like 1 or 2? I mean, it stands to reason. You know, but they just do it almost mathematically, like the computer, and they say, well, that last movie, that last blockbuster had only 5, you know, action sequences, so we have to have 8. But I have to say that, well, people, you know, at least at the box office, people seem to be responding to it. So I don't know if they're like lemmings or if they just have you know, it's...
Well, let's hope that they don't try that on Broadway when they say, oh, you know, this one had 6 ballads. Let's do 8. 8 ballads. Because that could be painful. So as we mentioned before, Manhattan Theater Club announced the extension of Choir Boy, but they also announced the extension of the Explorers Club. So it seems
I'm going on Tuesday.
You're going on Tuesday. Michael, you plan to see that?
I hope to, yeah.
Excellent. So... that's about it for us this week. You guys have anything you want to add?
Well, we have The Cradle Will Rock coming up at Encores, part of their new off-center, is that what it's called? Because it's a city center. Shows that, Cradle Will Rock never... Well, it did actually wind up playing on Broadway.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
And the whole history of it is, you know,
phenomenal.
It's just phenomenal. I certainly don't have the time to recount it here, but
my Critchlin and column this week dealt with it. So if James wants to put a link, you can find out about the very dramatic story of The Cradle of Rock and what happened when it was supposed to premiere. And I think that's a good thing.
Yes, and I got to interview Raul Esparza, who's playing Larry Foreman, the lead. So maybe we can, that should be up soon, and maybe we can put that in also.
Sure, that'd be great.
Be that part.
All right, and next week, as Michael previewed, we are going to be interviewing Harvey Schmidt. And we're actually going to interview Harvey on Monday evening. So if you're looking for the show, don't look for it until Tuesday, possibly Wednesday morning. So next week, Harvey Schmidt will be with us.
And I would say that can really be quite noteworthy, because Harvey has been in Texas for years, basically retired. He told me that most of what he's involved now is kind of putting their papers together, their materials, his and Tom Jones's, for donation to, I think he said they're hoping to donate them to the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. But he's not, you know, Tom has been very much still on the scene, because he's actively involved with the current production, revival or whatever word you want to use, of The Fantastic that's playing at the Snapple Center off Broadway. But Harvey, he's really has been in Texas for years. So I'm just really looking forward to speaking with him.
I agree.
Great. So that's something for us all to look forward to. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a link there for subscribing. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. That way you won't miss anything. If you'd be so kind, I haven't mentioned it in a few months, but head over to iTunes and leave us a review. The more positive reviews we have in iTunes, the more prominent that Apple features us and showcases This Week on Broadway on iTunes, and that will help us gain a lot more listeners. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us at Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. We can also be found on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your Android, your BlackBerry device, and that way it'll automatically stream to you. That way you won't have to download and sync it. Links to some of the things we've talked about can be found on the show page at BroadwayRadio.com, including contact information for Peter, Michael, and me. And we'd love to hear from you. We hear we get so many really nice emails every week from folks, and it's so wonderful to hear from everybody, and it really makes it worthwhile for us to keep doing this show. So please touch base with us if you have something to say. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, all.
How to observe personnel. How to select whom to lunch with. How to avoid petty friends. How to begin making contacts. How to walk into a conference room.